You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And.
Very excited for today's podcast. It's with Benoit Denezet-Lewis, one of the longest tenured contributing writers at New York Times Magazine, where he has authored cover stories and features about everything from severely anxious young people to overbred show dogs to iconic NFL moments, to transgender conservatives in the Trump era. So wide variety. A 2022 New America National Fellow and 2024 NEH Public Scholar. Benoit's work has been adapted into a feature film and featured on The Today Show, Good Morning America, and NPR programs, including On Point and Here and Now. He is the author of America Anonymous, Eight Addicts in Search of a Life, and the New York Times bestseller Travels with Casey, My Journey Through Our Dog Crazy Country. But his new book is called You've Changed, The Promise and Price of Self-Transformation. Enjoy the pod. Benoit, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Kelly.
In the introduction to your new book, you take us to this part of St. Paul, Minnesota that I actually know well because my wife grew up in St. Anthony Park.
Okay.
But this is a center I had never heard of that they refer to as a wet house. What is a wet house and what's going on there?
Yeah, so I went there years ago for a story for the New York Times Magazine. I've been interested for a long time in writing about addiction, as you mentioned. I wrote a book about it, and you know, pretty much all treatment centers in this country, with some exceptions, but for the most part, there is a kind of hope that like underpins it all, right? This kind of tomorrow, you know, one day at a time, tomorrow can be better. And St. Anthony Residence is essentially working on an entirely different model. So it's technically a harm reduction model, but it's basically a place for people who have for years, decades, struggled to get sober, often homeless, sort of at their last kind of, it's either there or the street or death. And mm-hmm. This place gives them a place to stay. They're allowed to drink. They get all kinds of services for their needs and their health needs. But it's essentially this place that says that, you know, when I went there, it was kind of shocking because it's sort of un-American, right? This idea we're going to give up on people and we've given up on redemption and there's no chance for them. Now, the people who run that program would not agree with that. There's no chance for them. In fact, one of the people, when I arrived that day, he was leaving and he had somehow gotten sober. So it's not impossible, but you know, the men that I met there were essentially saying there's, you know, not much hope for scoundrels like us. And mm-hmm. so they had sort of given up on, and interestingly, they saw it as a kind of honesty, a kind of self-awareness, right? Like they had spent so much of their lives, some of them saying, I'm going to change. I can change. I can be different. And I don't know if it's a protective measure or whatever it was, but it was a kind of, you know, I'm finally being honest with myself. This is who I am. This is what I am. So it was a very strange place. And I started the book there because in some ways, even though the book is, I think, pretty hopeful in the end, I think there is a lot of ways in which many of us have really mixed feelings about how much we can change, whether we can change. I think there's a protective measure that happens if we try to change, if we try too hard and it doesn't work, there's a kind of it's safer to not try and to give up. So there was a way in which these men, while a sort of really sad, dramatic case of this, sort of led me into this theme that's sort of there a little bit in the book, which is that we really have mixed feelings about how much we can change and whether we can change. And people say they're on team people can change or team people can't really change. But in reality, it's all mixed up and we're all sort of on both teams. So that's why I started with this very unusual place. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's why I started this conversation because so I booked you on the podcast based on the title of the book and the publicist. And part of it, of course, is I work at Second City and I've been here for nearly 40 years. And so many people come here to change their lives, right?
Yeah.
That we are a star factory, right? And whether right. whether they're doing – some of them are doing that because they want to be on Saturday Night Live or whatever. But the thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, whatever, millions at this point really are also coming just because like they don't know – something's broken in their lives and they think right. that taking an improv class, they might find something. So that's why right. I booked you. That's why I booked it. And then I had to pause and cancel us because I had
right.
open heart surgery,
yeah.
which this is my first podcast back from that. I'm all good. They did a
welcome
good job.
Back.
Thank you. So now I'm reading the book and I hadn't read it before. And it was the first one. I wasn't in a mood to read for the first 3 weeks, but I'm like, I'm curious about this now. And I did not know. You open with a story. I'm like, why are we opening with the story? And as I'm reading the thing that you do very deftly inside this book is that you are never really cynical about these movements. You've been part of them in terms of people trying to change. However, you're also sort of ruthlessly honest about the fact that for many people like, hey, you know, I know you've changed, but to me, you're the same asshole that you were before. Right. It's just you're calling yourself something different.
Right. Yeah, I try to. It is this combination of things in me. People have said over the years that I'm like empathetic, and I'm like, and I am sort of, I don't take people at face value, but I do give them a chance, and I am. And so, you know, sort of as a writer, you struggle with this question of like, well, how much am I putting my finger on the scale here for the reader about, you know, is my interpretation of their change or supposed change, if I'm going to come down one way or the other on that, there's a real danger in that. Well, I'll tell you a really quick story on sort of body language, sort of. So something, one of the guys that I write about, Michael Glatz, who used to be gay, decided he wasn't gay anymore. It was a whole big deal. He was a friend of mine, very strange transformation. We can talk about if you want. But when I went to visit him in his Bible school in Wyoming, which was a very strange place to meet him after working with him at a gay magazine and him being really anti-religion, we had this moment where this awkward moment where we hadn't seen each other for a while. And I remember it wanting to sort of go in for a hug. And then I remember him sort of being stiff and like not wanting to do that. And so we had this sort of awkward like handshake in the end. I wrote a story about him years ago. When the story came out, he said, Benoit, nice story. You know, I don't agree with all of it, but you know, you didn't lie. But he says this moment, he's like, I would have hugged you. Like you interpreted that wrong. And that's been a real, a learning moment for me in terms of just being a human, but also being a journalist. If you're a human and you make those mistakes, all right, fine. But if you're a journalist, because I wrote like that he was stiff and he didn't want to hug me, and that wasn't his interpretation of it at all. So anyway, it's just a brief example of kind of like how two people can sort of see a moment really differently. And for me, in this book, I guess I'm writing about, it's a big book, right? I'm writing about like spiritual change. I'm looking at gender, sexual orientation, politics. I'm trying to be open-minded. And at the same time, you know, for political identity changers, for example, I wish they would be a little bit more introspective. Most political identity changers, unlike other identity changers, tend to say, I actually didn't change. So most people who change their identity are like, I changed. You need to believe me. I need your buy-in. Political identity changers tend to say, I didn't change at all. I'm a bastion of intellectual consistency. Everyone else around me changed. When in reality, there's often emotional stuff going on under there. People in their tribe or group are mad at them. There's interpersonal relationships that are often underneath this. And so, you know, we try to project however we're changing, we try to project real certainty about it.
Yeah.
Because that's how we need to get other people to believe it. But there's so much doubt under all of it. And that was a really fascinating theme that sort of crept through, but we can't really talk about doubt because if we're doubting that we've actually changed, other people are going to disbelieve us. So we minimize the doubt.
That's right. And the gift you've been given this week, at least, or last week, is Tucker Carlson and Marjorie Taylor Greene all coming out. And then I can't help but remember when Glenn Beck did this, whatever, 8 years ago or 10, was suddenly like, hey, I'm sorry. And he's right back to where he was before. So you're also like, well, is this authentic? And I think the hard thing in terms of the political question is, you know, obviously the thing we should celebrate in human beings is recognition that we change, our opinions change. However, somehow, if you're president, that can't be the case. Which is like, what? And so this also feeds into, I think, your thesis, which is like, what are we really talking about here? And the personal thing for you, which I thought was interesting too, is, you know, your dad who worked at Esalen doing breath work.
Right.
And look, I'm someone who in various forms of therapy has really benefited. Breath work is not bullshit. I think breath work is really, you know, there's, my doctors have talked about it. It's like, and especially now where I'm trying to get back my lungs from my, I'm literally in that place of like, oh, my breath is better than it was, you know, a little while ago. And I had cardiac rehab this morning, which was also an examination. That stuff's very real, you know. And then you look at Esalen too, and I've got a funny Big Sur story for you.
But everyone has a funny Big Sur.
Yes, because there's other things going on there where you're just like, I don't know about that.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I resisted for years going to Esalen because of my dad's, you know, you don't want to just do your dad's thing. And in the book, I sort of realized with some horror that I have become him in many, many ways. And so this question of like, how much control do we really have over who we become is really interesting to me. Like we, you know, especially in our day of like, you know, all these influencers hawking these ideas and these theories and these products. I mean, this has always happened, but now with the internet and social media, it just sort of feels constant. There's always been hucksters promising easy transformation for a little bit of money or a lot of money. So, you know, we're in this moment where there's just a lot of that. And so, you know, it's an interesting, as someone who's trying to sort of go into this and figure out, okay, you know, and obviously I couldn't write about all of it too. I mean, even though the book is broad, I took myself into areas where I was really interested. How do we change in therapy? What does that mean to change in therapy? Therapists will tell you, I mean, you know, will say, you know, do people come to therapy? Do they really want to change or do they just want to sort of get better at their neuroses? You know, the therapists face this fundamental challenge with so many patients, which is they want to change and they're terrified of changing. So therapy became this really interesting place, both in my sort of experience to figure out, okay, what's working? You know, I went to a therapist who was really sort of unconventional and who wanted me to throw dishes and beat pictures of my parents with a baseball bat. And then, so I've tried many different kinds of therapy and I was sort of really interested in this question because these therapists all have this sense of like what they think change means and how it happens. So, you know, I did that. I went to Esalen. I went to a lot of transformation workshops. I watched as an observer a 3-month self-transformation course for people with personality disorders. And that was absolutely fascinating, Kelly, because, you know, like, so I don't have a personality disorder, but we all have imperfect personalities. We all have problematic personalities in some ways, right? We're human. Mm-hmm. And so it was fascinating for me to see my own self reflected in their experiences as they were trying to sort of, you know, overcome these seemingly really difficult things to overcome in their personalities. And it's interesting, in recent years, there's been a lot of books about you can change your personality, right? For everyone out there. And it's an interesting question. And I'm not convinced we can actually change our personalities all that much. I think we can tweak around the edges. And I think we can have powerful experiences. I talk to many people who do, whether it's psychedelics or just walking in the forest, we can have powerful, complicated, mystical experiences that shift our perspective and that open us up. And in some ways, if we think that's personality, yes. But even people who claim these big transformative experiences, people who know them will often say, yeah, their core personality, kind of the same. That, you know, they've gone from, you know, I read about a bully who turned into a Buddhist. You know, he was talking about, like, I don't really know what's changed with me. He's like, you know, I have different actions that has changed, but he was really honest about the ways in which, like, fundamentally he had stayed the same in some ways. And he joked that he likes to bully people into doing good now. But, you know, this really interesting question of, like, what changes and what stays the same when we change is fascinating. And Michael Glatz, who went from, you know, far left atheist gay man to conservative Christian supposed heterosexual, his core personality of a black and white thinker did not shift.
Right.
So, you know, and we see that often with politics, right? People will fling from left to right and they're saying different things, but they're saying it with the same supposed certainty and conviction and, you know, blindness to sort of gray areas. And we see that a lot with political change.
I thought, so Jeff Zlotnick is the name of the bully who turned into the Buddhist. And I thought this was very interesting to me for a number of reasons. One, I'm obsessed with Irving Goffman, and he talks about identity as performance.
Right.
And, you know, again, my background, but also I find that stuff really interesting.
Right.
And I was reflecting too on myself, which is like, I was in, when I was younger, I was a soccer player. That was my identity. I was very good. Mm. And I was also like such a jerk on the field. Like I needed to direct everyone and all that. And
right.
I often thought about where I ended up and how people perceive me. And I will tell people, like, oh, you wouldn't recognize me. And, like, almost everyone's just like, I would totally recognize you. You're not yelling at people, but you're doing the same thing, just in a completely different regard.
Interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. So it's, I think, and then that belies, again, like, as you point out, well, what is personality? And what Jeff talked about was his actions were different. And to me, at the end of the day, like, we can have all sorts of ideas about who we are. We can spout all kinds of things, but who is showing up?
Yeah.
And so I think the benefit of age for myself, and maybe this is true for you too, is that's what's going to show me, is it's like, what did you actually do or not do?
Yeah.
And the story of the book seems to be for yourself and others that becomes the crucial distinction.
Yeah. Yeah. And it is showing up. That's really interesting the way you put that. And I think it's interesting because just as much as I think there's a lot of mystery to change and we change in ways that we can't make sense of, a lot of like deep changes that people have, whether it's psychedelics or, you know, just other mystical changes are really terrifying for people can be really disorienting, and they're not afraid if it's how to interpret it or to tell other people. So I found that very fascinating. But there are these ways I think that we can. I wrote this piece in the New York Times recently where it was sort of like, you know, the headline was sort of like, stop trying to change because, you know, we don't control. And that's not exactly what I mean. We can, in fact, And we should, I think, have ways that we hope to change, right? Things mm-hmm. about ourselves, like we see ourselves. So I saw with myself, I saw that I was not showing up for my friends. I was not as I was not vulnerable. I was not showing up. I was mm-hmm. not in relationship the way that I wanted to be. And so for about the last 10 years, I made that a priority. And I'm certainly not perfect, but I made it a priority. I'm like, I want to be more honest, more vulnerable, more real in my relationships. And, you know, I had to do a lot of work on myself to sort of get there. But I, in many ways, my friends have like, have many of my friends, my close friends have said, you have changed in that way.
Yeah.
And so now is that personality? I don't know. My core personality is sort of the same, but I am a little bit less selfish and I am more willing to divulge of myself. And that's maybe that sounds like a small change, but that has kind of transformed my life. Because I've been able to do that with my parents, with my friends, this deciding that I wanted deeper, more real connections with people was probably, in addition to dealing with my addiction stuff, that was the thing that I wanted to do the most, actually, when I look back at the ways that I've tried to change.
To me, the story is about your dad. That's who it feels like you. And because you kind of give, it's the last line of my notes, where your dad says, the last thing many of us are willing to give up is our suffering, which is a very profound thing.
Yeah.
And it remind me, Irving Yalom once wrote, sooner or later, you have to give up the hope for a better past, which is a very similar sort of like this idea. You get to a certain point where you, only age and wisdom and quite frankly, getting the shit kicked out of you allows you to say something like that in a way that's honest.
Yeah.
And it feels to me like that was a, because it's like, you didn't have the easiest childhood and,
right.
you know, you're like, we're all born different in some regard and we're all penalized. I mean, I remember having, you know, I'm the youngest of six boys. My brothers were all hippies. I remember being on a schoolyard and having them do Ring Around the Burnout. This is before I had actually smoked pot. Led me to do that. Sure.
Right.
Thank you, friends.
Right.
But also then I look back at like what other people went through and I'm like, it ain't so bad. You know, I mean, and we're all dealing with that stuff. And so, you know, in many ways you're lucky in that you're able as an adult to have this relationship with your dad to give you whatever, some sense of closure or whatever
it is. And with my mom. I mean, I you know, it's been so fascinating. I don't know if you've seen this, Kelly, around the last couple of years. There's been a lot of stories in the media. There was one in the New York Times, the New Yorker. It's sort of been everywhere, this idea of cutting off your parents. And it's become really this sort of movement now. And I find it fascinating for a number of reasons. So on the one hand, I understand some parents are so abusive and, you know, that cutting them off makes sense. In other cases, I really wonder, because it's almost like when we do that, that it's an acknowledgement, we're giving up on them changing is what we're doing.
Yep.
And now maybe after 40 years of the same psychic cost, that makes sense, or 30 years. And I do want to clarify that makes sense for some people, but I find it fascinating. So I had a therapist who really encouraged us to tap into our anger towards our parents. And at no point did she say, you know, Benoit, you should stop contact. But one of her protégés is a sort of a no contact kind of leader. And I, you know, I am so grateful that I was able to work through challenges I had with my parents, especially my mom, and watch her change. And we both watched each other change and we both helped each other change. And to get to this point where I just, there's no, you know, recently we were talking and she doesn't love when I talk about her, so I'm not going to say much. But recently we were talking, I don't know, a year ago, and it seemed like she still was worried that I was angry or sad about my childhood. And I said, there's none of that left. Mm. You know, I don't know where it went. Maybe I spent enough years on it. There's just none of that left. And so being able to connect with my parents in the way that I have has been, again, life-changing and just an incredible experience. And many people don't get to have that. And I've been fortunate to get to have that while I've been working on this book about change, seeing my relationship with my parents deepen and shift. And that's been incredible. And I got to sit in on my dad does a weekly breathing and meditation discussion group. And I got to do that, we talked so much about change in that group over the last 10 years. And that was sort of going as I was going out into the world and talking to changers and would-be changers. So it was really beautiful to be able to be experiencing it in my own life, experiencing it with my husband, experiencing it with my parents, my friends. It was really special.
So I started Second City. I was a dishwasher, first job out of college. And all the founders were still around, right? And if they weren't here, they were alive. And the woman who was the producer at the time, her name was Joyce Sloan. She's passed away since, but legend. Like, she was the grandmother of all, John Candy, John Belushi, Gilda Radner. Right. Everyone came and paid homage at her office. Legendary.
Yeah.
And she definitely took me under her wing. And I remember I had this conflict. I'm the youngest of six boys, and one of my brothers married this horrible woman. They're not married anymore.
Okay.
and I was in my first marriage. She had done something unspeakable. I'm not even going to say it because everyone will hate her even more for this thing. But it really drove this wedge where I was not talking to my brother, even, who was maybe the brother I was closest with.
Wow.
And I remember
because he was defending her at the time.
Passively as he would.
Right.
Joyce, like, basically the Jewish grandmother in her came out, grabbed my ear. She's like, you have one family. And of course they're going to be idiots. Like, I don't even know what, like, are you assuming that that's not going to be the case?
Right.
Pick any of these people. It would be the same case. And she was the one who, like, pushed me into getting back in touch. And, like, and to this day, like I can't even imagine, had I driven that wedge.
Right.
What a terrible thing, basically, even to do for the comedy of everything that would happen after that with regard to the ex-wife. And so, like, hopefully we have in our lives, and it strikes me you have had this, like, mentors, and because you've had both, right? You had these therapists who were, like, giving you some not great advice, and others who were, like, sending you down that path where you could make that discovery for yourself.
Yeah.
Because the idea of, like, cutting it off to me is, like, well, then nothing ever gets resolved.
Nothing gets resolved. But I'll tell you, the experience, I mean, we're cutting each other off more and more. There's more and more reasons.
Right.
Yeah. There's more and more reasons I'll tell you, like, politics has transformed relationships. I spoke to a lot of, I've seen it in my own life, being able, like, struggling a little bit more to connect with people who had really different political views than I've had, which I've always prided myself on being able to do. It's been a little bit more of a struggle over the last few years. And I've noticed that with some shock. Many of the people I wrote about, when they changed, whether I agreed with the change or not is sort of irrelevant. I was interested in what would happen to them, their relationships, once they did shift. And relationships were completely torn apart. People had to move. It was like completely starting over. And that experience of starting over, I find, really interesting in whatever form it comes in, how we create community. You know, we have this idea that, you know, inner transformation, inner change is all inner. And we make the decision just based on our own sense of what's right for us and what we should be doing and all of that. And it's just rarely like that. And we have this idea that we shouldn't change for other people, but we change for other people all the time. Yeah. And we change in relationship to other people. We take on an identity sometimes because we need a group of people. We need a community, even if we have doubts about it. And so, yeah, the ways that we change in relationship to other people. And that became something that was throughout the book. I spent time with murderers who were trying to convince parole boards that they had transformed. And that was such a fascinating experience, talking to them and going through all of the parole board transcripts, because the California Parole Board wanted this kind of, I was solely responsible for my crime, and I am solely responsible for my transformation. They wanted this kind of very,
neither of which is true.
Yes, neither of which is true. And so it was just incredibly illuminating to watch how they had to narrate their transformations and then how they really understood it. So some of these prisoners not all, some California prisons, it's like you can be in groups and therapy all day long if you choose to. And some of these men did, and they were essentially spending a decade working on themselves in deep and profound ways. Some of these men were absolutely transformed. Others, it was a little less clear, and then others didn't even try. But, you know, how we project and like how you, Kelly, would interpret my change, whether I've changed or not, it's going to be based on body language. It's going to be based on the way I talk. It's going to be based on the way, whether you see yourself in me at all or whether I'm part of your group. And so then the guys themselves were like, yeah, I mean, I did the work, but I only changed because my family believed I could, because my mom visited me in 1980 and I looked across and I saw her and everything shifted after that moment. They were talking about changes much more communal than I think we like to. You know, that's a life or death situation. But we can extend that outward to what I like to call the parole board of the internet, where all of us are needing to, if we do something bad, convince other people that we have, that we're sincere, that we've transformed, that we've changed. And I'm fascinated by the ways that we choose to judge those transformations. And a lot of times it really doesn't make sense. Like, we're much more forgiving of people who are like us, who are part of our political group, than we are of other people. We're parsing apologies in a really interesting way. We're criticizing the timing. All of this is fair game, but it was something I found really interesting and wanted to explore in the book.
So in my world, the story that I would always tell that fits this is Louis C.K.
Yeah.
So I know all those ladies, and I knew at the time when Louis C.K. did what he did to those ladies because they talked about it. They joked about it. They laughed about it. They were creeped out about it. Like, but this is decades ago, right?
Right.
And so, and also, I was a fan. Like, I found his work to be profound in terms of the kind of truth telling and comedy. So that when one discovers that he's done the stuff, you're like, and to me, it was like, oh my God, the gift would be if he finds a way to turn this lens on himself and come out even stronger. And he didn't do it. He did the old trope of moving right. He did that. Like, it is profoundly disappointing to me. And then when people talk about him being canceled, you're like, he's selling out Madison Square Garden. I don't think that's canceled. Nothing has been canceled.
Right.
Other than I'm disappointed by someone who I thought had more, I don't know, what is it I'm looking for? Like, well, I think it's insight, and you, there's a thing.
It's a big word, insight.
Well, you talk about this with the parolees, where they failed to demonstrate insight.
Right.
And when you talk about it in that context, there is a kind of a sadness to that, because you're like, I don't know that they even know how to, whereas I am sure Louis C.K. knows how to.
Knows how to, yeah, or could perform it.
Or I could mean, perform it.
Yeah, I mean, it is interesting. Insight, yeah. With the parole, with the guys trying to get parole, they had to, I mean, they had to like go deep for years yeah. into their childhood trauma, and they had to like really understand it, but they couldn't blame it. So they had to understand it, understand how it affected them without blaming it. It's a really fine line. And then they had to understand what their triggers, right? Like what sets them off. I'll tell you, there was one guy where it was sort of, depending on the parole hearing, I was like, oh yeah, he's transformed. Oh no, he hasn't. Mm-hmm. There was another guy who was just clearly transformed, and anyone who knew him before, would echo that. There's this funny story about one of the guys in, wrote a book after he was paroled, and he says, you know, I wish I could find, and I'm paraphrasing, I wish I could find people in the real world who were as like introspective as the guys that I hung around with in prison. It was an interesting idea, but yes, this insight, I mean, you can really only change yourself if you sort of are willing to look at yourself. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes things happen in mysterious ways, right? Psychedelics can teach us something that we didn't intend to, or that we hadn't really seen.
Tragedy.
We'll, Yep. And grief.
And we'll, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, I look at, we lost our daughter to cancer when she was 17. Mm. And that profoundly moves everything. And my friend Scott Barry Kaufman talk to me about post-traumatic growth and this idea of taking that situation and trying to find something out of it, which I think is where we ended up. But the and there's, I don't know if you know Kurt Gray's work. You refer to it with regard to this idea of the one way to mend sort of political divide often is these shared stories of harm.
Right.
But they have to be authentic.
Right.
And I know for myself, because I will go down and do talks. I do a lot of public speaking. I'll go down to Florida into Trump country. I will do my rap about improv. Everyone's grooving with it. They, you know, if they know how I vote, they have a pretty good idea of the way I am. But right. but when I talk about Nora and losing her and what that meant and how that's impact, there's no politics. There are people who be like, can I give you a hug?
Right.
And I'm like, oh, that's and I don't know that that's a bad thing. Strikes me as like, can we just let ourselves be human together?
Right.
Because we all face this.
Yeah. And that was really one of the more inspiring things that I saw going door to door with those folks who were doing deep canvassing.
Deep canvassing.
I mean, on one level, you're like, you're going up to a stranger's door, you know, what do you think's going to happen? And then incredible things happened, you know, and it was, you know, there's a way in which it's like, it can feel hopeless, right? Like, can you talk to enough people to make a difference? Probably not. Maybe in a very local election, but it was inspiring to see this guy, Dave Fleischer, who spent the last decades with his young volunteers going door to door and, connecting with people who think differently. And, you know, I didn't really totally believe it until I saw him do it. And people who disagreed with him were like, you know, they started really ornery. And by the end, they're like, do you have to leave? You know?
Yeah.
So not every conversation's like that. We had conversations that were like, oh my God, I can't even, you know? So you're reminded both of the possibility and of the challenges when doing that kind of work. But I found it interesting in this question of like, how much can we really change our beliefs? Can someone, is it the conversation? Is someone convincing you with facts? Probably not. It's some deeper connection. And then it takes the person some time to sort of reflect on it. And, you know, it's also, you add someone trying to change your mind on your doorstep, you sort of instinctively want to sort of, you know, say, well, you're not going to change my mind. I'm not going to let you change. You know, there's a kind of like thing, and that's a very human thing. Like, you're not going to change my mind. But yeah, I'm attracted to people who are willing to have their minds changed, just generally in my life. And so it can feel like there's fewer and fewer of those people, but, I find that an attractive quality in a person.
I wonder too, you know, in terms of trying to make sense of the world we've lived in for the whatever period of time.
Yeah.
I mean, you do wonder whether we had to go to this level to get to the thing you're talking about, which is, can we all just sort of see this now that we don't want this insanity, that we do want for us to be able to have a common cause, be able to disagree and move together. That might be true. I know we're writing a new show. Well, we've been writing Second City shows during this whole time, which is also fascinating because we do political and social satire.
Yeah.
So like, what is the audience interested in? Not interested.
Yeah.
I can tell you, they're not interested in hearing us do 2 hours of Trump jokes.
Yeah.
They don't want it.
Yeah.
What they want is genuine surprise and connection in a moment. And I'm like, well, I get that. I mean, I've just sat home for 5 weeks, right? So I'm home with media, and I'm like, this is not where I want to be.
No.
You know, let alone the fact that like, I was just promoting to someone that I'm trying to watch the NBA playoffs and they're on a different channel every night. And I'm like, who decided this? So it's such a metaphor for everything. It's like, I can't find it. And like,
I think it's important to acknowledge that we're living through a time of disorienting, crazy making, scary time. And I see it with my students. I teach at a college in Boston. I teach Emerson College in Boston. And I see it with my friends. And, you know, loneliness is up, depression, anxiety, all of it's up. And in the last chapter of the book, I try to, I don't know, look forward, give some hope, with focusing on this famous phrase, be the change you want to see happen. And, you know, for years, that's been a big mantra, especially on the left, but it's a Rorschach test. You can interpret it as a kind of either very outward political thing or this inward focused thing that is then going to emanate outward and you're going to transform the world with your energy. So I found, and it's been said for years, it's been assumed that Gandhi said it, and Gandhi said very similar things, but he didn't say that. It's this woman in Arizona who's, I think, 86 or 87 now, who I spent time with. And, you know, to try to figure out, like, all right, we're at this potential turning point, and how do we be the change today? And it's a really interesting question. I think a lot of people are struggling with how much of the news can I take in? How much of the world can I take in? What is the ethically responsible balance of staying informed and feeling all of the world's pain and not doing that and focusing on yourself? So that's become a really, I end the book there because I'm also thinking about that. Like, how do we be the change? What is the right way to live? What is the right combination of inner work and looking outward, trying to change the world or our communities? We can keep it really local, but essentially trying to change things outside of us versus try to change things inside of us. And that balance a lot of people are struggling with right now. And my students are struggling with it. But I do think it's an interesting question. And this woman she's like, you know, we're on the brink of something. It might not be pretty. Mm-hmm. You know, we might, it, yeah, I mean, it, she's very, very hopeful, but you know, she, but she's also very honest too about where we are.
Can I tell you my big story?
Yeah.
So tomorrow is my 30th wedding anniversary, second marriage.
Congrats.
Yeah, great. So on our honeymoon, we did the Napa thing and then up into Big Sur. We stayed at the Post Ranch Inn. Beautiful. Ooh. I mean, could never afford it. Probably couldn't afford
it. It's so expensive now. It's so very expensive. Fancy. Yes.
So we're in this little sort of waiting pool that goes, it descends over the mountains. They bring cognac out for us. We're sitting there. And it's a beautiful night, and these two gentlemen come up like, are we going to be bothering you if we come in? And we're trying to be nice. Like, no, come on into the reflecting pool with us. So my wife and I are listening to their conversation, and these are the words that are spoken. Dude, you have got to get the Golf Channel. It will change your life. So this is, 30 years ago. This is what he thought would change someone's life.
Right.
Look, God love golfers. I don't understand how that might change their lives, but I certainly understand Big Sur in terms of I have never been to a place quite frankly more beautiful in my life.
It's stunning, and many people have Arlene Lawrence, the woman I was just talking about, who coined Be the Phrase. She had her one of her transformational moments in 70 69 70, I can't remember, but she saw a flower. She became one with the flower. It was a transformative experience. She was with her husband, actually. And she's like, yeah. She's like, my husband is like, what happened? And she's like, I don't know, but I don't know if I really want to be married to you anymore. I mean, it wasn't that instantaneous, but sort of the way she describes it, it was this turning point for her. And we do have these moments of epiphany, realization, awe. I mean, humans have had them forever, and they can be really powerful, special moments, and they can be transformative. At one of the workshops I went to, she really pushed us. She's like, all of you have had moments. Now, you might not think of it as like, oh, my life totally changed, but you've had moments of awe, epiphany, wonder, where you felt a larger connection, or you felt different in connection with other people or to the world. And I think that's true. I think many people have had those experiences, and they can be transformative. I have a whole chapter about it because I found it so fascinating. This question of like these moments, do we trust them? Does change really happen that quickly? How do we continue it? Bring it back to the real world. I found all of that really, really interesting.
I'm going to ask you for your yes and story to end the podcast. And I was real curious whether it was going to be from the book at that concert.
Oh, is that the story you want me to tell? Well,
no,
that was a,
you
tell, that was
you
a no,
whatever story you want to tell.
That was a no, because it was,
I guess it was a no. I guess
it was a no.
No.
It was a no. And no, my yes and story, the one at the concert was, I basically, just to tell people, I had this moment where I had to sort of decide. I heard this voice. I had to decide if it was true, if I was going to go up and give my life to God, and I didn't. But what would have happened if I had? Would I have?
I
then
think
had
that could be construed as a yes and that you avoided the false prophet.
Yeah. Okay. Yes, I can see that. Yep. I'll tell a story. Maybe about meeting my husband. And I would have all my friends and a big part of myself was like, no, this can't work. he's Czech. He was just here for the summer 10 years ago. Totally different. It's fascinating. We'll be walking down the street, and I'll see one thing, he'll miss that. He'll see some other thing that I'll miss. So we just see the world entirely differently. So different. And so everyone, my best friend had dinner with him, and he's like, he said to my now husband, not thinking he'd be my husband, he's like, all right, have a nice life. We're never going to see you again. And so the yes was to this unsure inner knowing, I guess, that I would give this unlikely thing a chance and try to like fashion a relationship with someone who lives far away, who wasn't planning to move, and to give it a shot. And, you know, 10 years later, we are together. And I find it remarkable because it's very unusual. And most of that time, I'm able to go over there because I'm a professor. I have time off. He can come here a little bit. But, you know, we're gone. We're not together. There's like month and a half periods where we're not together. And everyone's like, how do you make this work? And I don't know. I just, you know, we love each other so, so much that it was able to overcome this thing. So we fashioned this relationship that no one really understands because we don't live together. And, you know, it's just, but that was a moment where it was like, it would have been very easy. And I spent first 2 years in therapy, talking to my therapist, being like, this can't work. Like, why am I doing this? This can't work. This can't work. And I'm very grateful for her that she never actually said, you know what? Yeah, it sounds like this is probably not going to work. She never put her thumb on the scale. And now I'm really happy that I'm married to him. So that's my sort of unlikely, you know, instinctively the answer was no. And I said yes. And part of it was like this choice to love him and to make that work.
I think when I think about the book, that story, Yes And, I think about the fact that when you're coming here and we're teaching you the Yes And principle, we're basically saying this is low stakes. This is a low stakes environment for you to just simply validate the thing that the person said to you and act upon it and build upon it. That's all.
Right.
And then people do it and they're like, that's profound. And you're like, yes, you idiot. We're all doing this. We are cutting it off before you can see that anything. And we do this across the board.
Right.
You know, we do it in our jobs. We do it politically. We do it in relationships. Right?
Yeah.
And so those people who don't make it onto Saturday Night Live or whatever, at least can take this idea and move it into their life of like, look, just try it on for a little bit. And you just don't know what's going to happen. And as you've discovered, and I think you probably knew this instinctively as a journalist, which is like, if you give people a shot, they're fascinating. They have more to teach you.
Absolutely.
So I don't know. I mean,
it's the biggest gift of being a journalist and a magazine writer and being able to go and be in community with people who are very unlike me. I did it more when I was younger, but I still do it. And it is an incredible gift. And it's made me just much more open to people. And some of my friends are like, yeah, you're a little bit too open to people in the sense that you're giving them benefit of the doubt. But I feel like I can find connection with a lot of people if given enough time and willingness.
The book is fantastic. It's called You've Changed, The Promise and Price of Self-Transformation. Benoit, thank you for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me. It was really fun.
Getting the Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Aridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Emma Smith and Colleen Fahey. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.